on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
By paying attention to your dream state as a kind of ritual way you self-investigate, you are working with your mind's ability to go to sleep and allow intuitive perception to rise up. And if you're allowing this in your perception of your dreams and writing them down in your dream journal and then comparing your dreaming experience to your waking life, my belief is that that strengthening that muscle in your dream relationship will allow a person to be more able to hear the still small voice while they are awake.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author, psychologist, and dream interpreter, Dr. Michael Lennox, to discuss his book, Psychic Dreamer, Exploring the Connection Between Dreams and Intuition. Michael and I discuss the universal meaning behind dream imagery, intuition as forward memory, how we are always dreaming, visitation dreams, and night terrors and multidimensionality. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Dr. Michael Lennox is a practicing psychologist and one of the most respected and sought-after dream interpreters in the U.S. He has appeared on Sci-Fi, MTV, and many radio shows, and has published articles in Today's Woman, TV Guide, and other magazines. He's the author of Dream Sight, a Dictionary, and A Guide for Interpreting Any Dream, Llewellyn's Complete Dictionary of Dreams, and Llewellyn's Little Book of Dreams. He joins me today to discuss his latest publication, Psychic Dreamer, Exploring the Connection Between Dreams and Intuition. Michael, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Nick.
Yes, well, thank you. I'm looking forward to this because I have an abiding interest in dreams.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and I've done a few episodes on dreams. But let me ask you, before we get into the book, for my audience who may not be aware of you and your work, what got you interested in dreams?
It really started in childhood. Mm-hmm. Right. So it had to start, of course, with the idea that I was just an avid, vivid dreamer with a great imagination. And I was fascinated with dreams. And we talked about them in my house. Mm-hmm. Right. So that dreams and having them was something that I was probably more engaged with than the average, you know, like 9-year-old. When I was a teenager at 15, I stumbled across Freud's interpretation of dreams. And that was enough for me. Like, I knew who Freud was. I loved dreams. And I thought, well, I'm going to read that book. Now, I don't know what my 15-year-old self got from reading that book, but I certainly came away with an understanding that dreams had value and that they could reveal things if you know, he used the word analyze them, that they could reveal things of the unconscious. And I understood enough at 15 about what the unconscious was. We were a fairly progressive household growing up. So that just translated into experiences in the hallways of high school. Kids, as they do, and adults too. I had the craziest dream last night, and I would just use those experiences to ask my friends to share their dreams with me. And I always had something to say in response. Now, I didn't know what I was doing back then, but I know now what I was doing, that I have a gift. The gift isn't that I know things about meaning that other people don't know. The meaning in dreams is derived from the principle of universality, meaning what would be the thing that most people would agree that an item might represent? Like if I hold up my cup of water, then that item has a meaning of my ability to take something toward me that is necessary for life, right? That's the symbolic meaning, but it's based on what a cup is. And this cup happens to be filled with water, right? So if I'm hearing a dream, my mind is attaching the universal meaning to the symbols that make up the story you are telling me. And then I can tell a story about the story. So my gift isn't that I know things that are not knowable. If I explain something to you universality-wise, you'd get it. the gift is that I can do this so fast that as I'm hearing the dream, I've got something to say, you know, in response. So that experience of having beautiful, intimate, juicy conversations with people about something that was happening inside them was so satisfying that I just followed that breadcrumb trail into my adult life. And eventually, by the time I was in my late 20s, I was holding workshops, teaching people about interpreting dreams, even though I was a complete amateur, didn't really, really know what I was doing, but I trusted the gift. And then followed those, you know, into, you know, my later adult life, where I eventually decided to devote myself to this. And I started, you know, my grad school work in psychology.
Okay, wonderful. Can I ask what kind of branch of psychology you practice?
Well, if I were a practicing psychotherapist at this time, which I'm not, I'm a psychologist because I have a doctorate in psychology, and anybody with that degree can call themselves a psychologist.
Right.
The area of psychology that sort of lights me up would be in the modern world called depth psychology, mm-hmm. which is the modern way we describe Jungian.
Right.
Psychology. So yes, my love for psychology is definitely in the camp where we're looking at meaning, universality, archetypal consciousness, right. which Freud wasn't doing at all, but Jung sort of brought to our psyche. And so yes, yeah. that is the area of psychology that most lights me up.
Yeah. Depth psychology is my wheelhouse too. So
yeah, of course. It's the place where modern psychology meets a kind of modern spirituality, because we're looking at the meaning behind things in depth psychology.
Right. Yeah. And I think depth psychology is on the verge of, I don't know, it just seems to me that it's where we're heading, that collectively there's this renewed interest in soul and meaning and everything. And I think that, depth psychology is where it's at. So there are different kinds of dreams, and one of the kinds of dreams are precognitive dreams. And I found your book interesting because with the title Psychic Dreamer, the first thought is, oh, okay, you know, this is going to be all about precognitive dreams, but you cover a lot of different kinds of dreams that, so the title is better, I think, Psychic Dreamer. But let's start with precognitive dreaming. I've had a few guests on who've written books on precognitive dreaming, and the conversation is always interesting. But let me ask you, when did you first notice, perhaps in your dream work, that there was such a thing as precognitive dreams?
When I was in high school, I was involved in a dance company experience. We had a dance company in my high school. I was a creative theater kid. And so we'd spent 2 hours of my gym for junior and senior year was spent in this large room that was essentially a dance studio, wood floors and whatnot. So the dream I had was sitting cross-legged in a circle with a bunch of people that weren't known to me, but it was a familiar sensation, which is typical of dreams, right? And that was it. It was just an image of sitting cross-legged in a circle. Only 3-4 days later, there was an emergency meeting in the special dance thing. And we were like, let's all sit in a circle. And everybody was sitting around in cross-legged in a circle. And it was, I didn't notice it right away, but I suddenly got hit about 4 or 5 minutes into this experience of remembering that I had this dream and this just innocuous sense of a dream thing showing up in my waking life. So that alerted me to the idea that there was something possible to have a perception in the dream state of things that might come about. Now, this was there's no lottery winning numbers in this, dream. It was so innocuous, but it did alert me, Nick, to looking for those kinds of experiences with other people. I am not a strong precognitive dreamer, but man, oh man, I've met people through my studies where routinely they're having dreams that feel a little bit different to them than the average dream that winds up being something that then comes about in their waking life.
Yeah, I've had some precognitive dreams. I've been keeping a dream journal since I was a teenager, and it's really good to do that for a number of reasons, but I've been able to say, you know, like hold up the journal. I'm like, look, I dreamt about this like 3 days ago and it came to be. So it's a nice verification for that. But in terms of the precognitive dreams, is there a kind of a pattern or a similarity to them? Because I've noticed that when I have the precognitive dreams, that it is something that is very ordinary, kind of like what you described, you know, with the sitting in the circle. And it's usually just something a few days out.
That is typically how I've experienced it in terms of my listening, that it is, there's a fairly quick turnover of dreamed event and life event. I do think that so many of them are innocuous, but what the value is, Nick, of even doing this, like when you talked about getting excited about, look, I wrote this down. That's the value in paying attention to the dreams. Sometimes we have this sort of perception that like that waking life is on and sleeping life is off, and that we're not really present when we're asleep and we are present when we are in our waking state. But that's not true at all. Right? The thinking mechanism that guides us during our waking life that says turn right, turn left, put on a sweater, it got cold out, is the same mind that we identify as like, well, that's me. That's I know who I'm talking to and it's me. The intuitive voice, they don't call it the still small voice for nothing. It's quiet ways we move through our life getting guidance that if we can listen to that guidance, we feel like we're in the flow. We might make less mistakes. There's a sense of like working with the universe when we operate intuitively like that. By paying attention to your dream state as a kind of ritual way you self-investigate, you are working with your mind's ability to go to sleep and allow intuitive perception to rise up. And if you're allowing this in your perception of your dreams and writing them down in your dream journal and then comparing your dreaming experience to your waking life, my belief is that that strengthening that muscle in your dream relationship will allow a person to be more able to hear the still small voice while they are awake. How many times have you said or heard people say, damn, I had the instinct and I didn't listen to it? That's the missing of intuition. That's the still small voice being overrode by the rational mind that thinks it's everything. By allowing yourself to let the dream world show you how easy it is to perceive things that may come about, I think you increase your ability to do that while you're awake.
Interesting. I forget where I read it, but I read somewhere, someone made the comment that we're always dreaming, even when we're awake, that we're always dreaming, but it's that ego, that consciousness mind is in the way.
Yeah. So think about this, Nick. We know a lot about the brain and perception from a scientific place. And certainly one of the things we know is that what we're seeing is not what's real. Two things. One is that we're seeing this slim, tiny bit of vibrational light. And we know that even I can see this, I'm bathing in wild amounts of light vibration that are there that I can't perceive. So right there is something that says there's something happening that my little perception can't feel, but maybe my bigger perception can. Right. And so when we allow that, I think we just wake up that ability to sort of perceive those quieter voices when, you know, when they're being blocked out by the rational mind. That rational mind goes to sleep when we do. So we're able to perceive something in all of these ways that the book outlines, you know, shared dreams, visitation dreams, right, precognitive dreams. But your comment, I love that idea that we're always dreaming in the same regard that I'm only seeing little bits of light, but I'm in much more. And then if by ipso facto, if I'm experiencing this dynamic perception when I'm asleep because my rational mind can't interfere, it stands to reason that those realms are present when we are awake, just as vibrantly, and we touch into them with meditation and disciplines that open us up to perceiving flow and intuition while we're awake. And then this comes full circle back to, if you pay attention to your dream life, you will have a richer experience of all of this intuitive perception in your waking life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it's this model maybe of the world, in a sense, of that there is consciousness and it's foundational. When we think of the unconsciousness, it's there.
Always.
Yeah, like it's not, always.
That's the idea. It's not an on-off switch that we're right in consciousness and we're awake and then it turns off and we're in the unconscious. It's all present, always. And I believe my personal experiences, when we are tapped into those greater perceptions on a Tuesday, it's a better Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like we're also being shifted away from this idea that dreams are just garbage in, garbage out, you know, and I know personally, having recorded my dreams, that some of my dreams are that.
Well, yes, know? Nick, one function of dreaming has nothing to do with mysticism or perception. Right. The brain is lighting up with everything you've experienced during the day. Everything you said, everything you heard, everything you touched, smelled, ate, touched. We have to take all of that material and review it, turn some of it into memory because it's important, get rid of all the rest. And so this review of the day is one of the functions of REM sleep. In fact, the scientists will tell you this is happening in REM sleep. Therefore, there's nothing mystical happening in REM sleep, which is hubris and bullshit. Right. It's that this is happening in dreams and this is happening in dreams and that is happening in dreams. So when you say garbage in, garbage out, absolutely one function of dreams is to clean up the garbage. Mm-hmm. So you can look at that and say that's what's happening in dreams, but it's only one sliver of what's happening in dreams.
Yeah. To kind of go back to the precognitive dreaming a little bit, what do you think is going on? Because, and I asked this question because one of the guests that I had on that wrote a book on this, it was Gary Lachman. He made the statement. He's like, this should be impossible. according to the laws of physics and whatnot, it should be impossible because we experience linear time.
Right.
And I know that there are some other ideas about what's happening, but I'm curious what your take is.
Well, we are in linear time, right? Which means we can only experience a kind of moment in the body. And I like to say the body is the only part of us that's ever and always and only in the present moment. Mm-hmm. It's our mind that can see a little bit further into the future. Well, the mind can, you know, perseverate about the future, perseverate about the past, and we call one depression and one anxiety, right? But think about perception and the mind. The tiny mind that I'm describing always as the sort of limiting mind that we know to be ourselves, but is really just the navigating mechanism. The intuitive mind is still a kind of mind perception, which means, I believe, that if our rational mind can think about tomorrow and Thursday and next Monday, our intuitive mind must also be able to be in the present moment and aware of the moments to come. You know, I'm an astrologer as well, and I'll just throw in there, like, the archetype of Capricorn is the goat that climbs up to the top of the mountain. And so everybody thinks of Capricorn as just being about goals and ambition. And it is. But there's a spiritual depth to the idea that I climb a mountain of consciousness, right? And in a dream, if this were a goat climbing a mountain in the dream, the mountain would be conscious awareness itself and climbing to a higher place. Why? For a better vantage point. So I don't have a technical or scientific explanation for how we can perceive, but I know if the rational mind can perceive into the future, the irrational mind isn't locked in to where the body is either. It sort of vibrates out a little bit and might transcend the limits of time in a linear fashion. You know, when I was young, I used to call intuition because I was always interested in how intuitive I could be and developing it, writing down impulses I got. And, you know, I used to call intuition forward memory because it felt the same as remembering something that had happened, like a vague impression of, oh, yeah, I remember that, that the forward memory was the same. Oh, I anticipate that. So I don't know if that was a very satisfying answer, but like that's
no, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm just kind of curious. I wanted to ask because I know that there are different answers to this question, and we'll move on to some other kinds of dreams here. But I did want to ask another one, and this kind of goes to the idea of universality in a sense. So it seems like often the precognitive dreams that people have, you know, they're fairly innocuous in terms of like, you know, you and the group meeting. And some of mine have been about work, you know, and jobs and whatnot. But aren't there also, I think, reports of people who have had precognitive dreams about something outside of themselves or collective? I know that there are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that it is typical to have the innocuous precognitive experiences, but if you grabbed an average 10 people, three or four of them would have a story of, you know, dreaming about event before it came. I certainly heard lots of people talking about dreams just before 9/11 that did not make any sense until 9/11 happened. And then it was like, oh, did that dream portend this big event? You know, I had an experience prior to 9/11 that wasn't a dream, but like a panic moment where I, like 2 days before it, I had to leave an event, a barbecue. I was like, something bad is about to happen. But it felt to me like that afternoon, I just knew I had to be home.
Right.
It wasn't a year had passed before I realized, oh, I was having a waking dream intuiting an event. And so what happened, I was hearing from dreamers in, you know, years later going, you know, I think this might connect to that. I've heard stories, and I think there are some in the book, none of which I'll be able to remember now, so please don't ask, where the big ones came along and someone had a dream that was precognitive about a big event. And so this goes back to, that's the value of paying attention to your dreams, because it's a muscle. And if you strengthen the muscle, both of the perception and the ability to remember the dreams when you've woken up in the morning, will put you in a place where you're more likely to have the big guidance dream when it's ready to come.
Yeah. I had a dream last night that there was another pandemic. So let's hope that that was something else.
That's not a precognitive dream, Nick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this one, it was a pox of sorts. So, yeah. But there was a collective aspect. I was on a bus. So, yeah. Let's keep our fingers crossed. We don't want that. Yes. We do not want that. I'll just say one last thing. And this is one of the other guests that I had. He was talking about dreams before 9/11. And his experience was, he did, and this kind of goes back to that, you know, just like everyday stuff. He didn't actually have the dream of 9/11 itself. What he had was the dream about him reading about 9/11.
Wow. That's so direct.
Yeah.
Right? That's a dream about his own experience in relationship to a large experience. That's fascinating to me because that's a true precognitive dream that's involving him in his little body, where his body was going to have the experience of 9/11 through reading about it.
Right.
So somehow there just has to be something that transcends the limits of the now moment, which I think is also another hubristic sort of moment. It's like, if science tells us that we're in this, you know, pulse of now and time works this way, and science says precognitive shouldn't work or shouldn't happen, but it does.
Right.
The flaw is not in the dream experience. It's in what science is describing it as.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot science can't answer at the moment. And consciousness is one of them. And that would include dream consciousness,
yes,
I think.
Yes,
yes. So I want to move on, and we're not going to go into every single thing that you write about. You know, we really want to encourage people to get the book, but there are a couple of kinds of dreams that fall under this category of psychic dreaming that I do want to look at. One is, I'm going to go a little bit out of order from what how you write them in the book, but visitation dreams.
This is my favorite of all of the mystical topics. And I don't know why this is making me emotional, but the reason it's my favorite, Nick, is I've had so many experiences where such a dream experience changed a person. Mm. I have had that beautiful, like, holding of the, and then grandma visited, and now I know
right
that there's way more, and it's undeniable. So what do we know about visitation dreams? So the idea first is obviously someone has to have passed out of their body, and then they visit within the dream of someone who is, you know, beloved and having lost them. How you know you're in a visitation dream and not a regular dream, even a regular dream involving the person, the beloved who has passed away, is a visitation dream is always and only going to be very singular in its setting. So if you have a dream of someone who's passed away and it's a storyline, narrative dream, even if it's not wacky and crazy like clown cars and upside down hills, if it goes somewhere in a story, you're not in a visitation dream. You're in a process dream where the aspect of you that's represented by that person is playing out some dynamic storyline in your dream state. A visitation dream is going to take place in the room that you're sleeping, an idyllic setting, perhaps, lots of benches in parks. I mean, it sounds like a trope in a movie, but I'm telling you, you know, several dozen people over the years have said, I was sitting on a bench in a park and, you know, dad or brother or grandma came and visited. The message is always also very singular and often is not even spoken in audible words, but a felt sensation. And if it is words, it's always, I love you, all is well, you know, something very simple and affirmative. And then, of course, there's the big thing that makes it known as a visitation dream is how it feels to the dreamer, both within the dream itself and waking up from it. And the most juicy moments for me as someone who has heard dreams is watching people who I know life before that dream was built through a kind of disconnect from spiritual sensibilities. And then a dream like this will revolutionize someone's sense of, oh, wow, that was real. Mm. And of course, on a level, it was. Yeah. We are that connected to each other energetically in the body, and the end of the body's inhabitants by us is not the end that we think it is.
Right. Yeah, I'll share two things with you. And I want to comment on the bench. But first, one of the most profound experiences, dream experiences that I ever had was the morning that my grandfather died. I was raised by my grandparents. And my grandfather was taken away in the middle of the night for an emergency, and he had an abdominal aneurysm, and he died on the operating table when they were actually closing him up. And I was home by myself, and I was awake for a little while and just kind of waiting to hear what's going on. And eventually I'm like, okay, I'm going to go back to sleep. And so when I went back to sleep, I had a dream of when I was a little kid, I would stand in my backyard waiting for my grandfather to come home from work. And he had this red Ford pickup truck. And in the dream, I was in the same spot that I would always be at as a kid. So it's that singular setting. And I saw my grandfather walking up to his truck, and he stops and he looks at me and he just waves.
That's it.
And then he got into the truck and drove off.
That's it.
That also would have been at around the same time that he would have died.
That he was passing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you hear enough of these experiences, like, then our crazy perceptions that we, you know, have such trouble holding on to, we'll have this fabulous, numinous experience. Maybe we're doing, you know, working with plant medicine to have a kind of, you know, expanded, you know, experience. And it's very easy to distrust the realness of it. And I think then the more experiences that we can have where it's like, okay, I guess I really can't deny this idea that if nothing else, that the way I'm perceiving is just this tiny and limited. And there's just so much more going on in terms of our perception that transcends the limits of the mind. Yeah. And none of those limits exist when we're sleeping.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and no one can ever tell me that that was not my grandfather coming to say goodbye. You know?
That's right. Right.
Yeah.
And then what I love about hearing this dream is that it is a singular setting and a conveyance of an all as well in the form of a wave, but it also had sort of a creative setting that was personal, that reminded you of the connection. And I would say there's a connection between the little boy that you were waiting for grandpa and the relationship that sparked that anticipatory waiting and the love that caused him to wave as he was leaving his body. Yeah. Yeah, driving off in the car is a beautiful symbol of my body's done. We're going somewhere else.
Right.
Bye.
Well, the other one I wanted to mention is, and this was not a dream that I had. It was a dream my brother had, and it features a bench. And that's why I was so interested that you mentioned that there's almost always this bench. My parents passed away just months between each other. And my mom ended up in hospice and she was in a coma for about 3 weeks, almost a month. And my brother had a dream about my dad. And my dad was in a mall. And my mom loved malls. My mom, malls and Walmart, that was her life. But it was just my dad was in a mall sitting on a bench.
Sitting on a bench.
Yeah. And my brother, and there was no communication, but my brother told me he knew that my dad was there waiting for my mom.
Oh, no, that's beautiful. I love that. And the knowing piece is the one that gets me the most sort of jazzed up because it's reflecting a change in the person having the perception. Mm-hmm. Your brother was changed by that dream, whether he acknowledges it or not. I mean, that is a moment where we get the curtain raises up and we glimpse behind it and we get to say, wow, there's so much more here than meets the eye. I find that very comforting.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there is this ongoing, I mean, for as long as probably humans have been around, connection between dreams, sleep, and death.
Absolutely. Part of my spiritual practice includes that I treat my going to bed as a practice of death. I have a prayer that says I welcome the sweet death of sleep so that I'm practicing the idea that we are going into a place in a realm that's a bit like death. And if there is something that exists beyond the consciousness of inhabiting a body, my guess is that it resembles the dream state more than the waking state.
Yeah. 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 No, I agree with that. I think it's maybe even the same place.
Maybe even the same place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly there's a lot of First Nations perspectives that the modern sort of verbiage around this is that, you know, that the dream world is more the real world and that like this is the dream that we're having. Yeah. And I identify with that as well, that my beingness is much bigger than the part of me that's having a dream of my life.
Right.
I'm a big being having a dream of Michael.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like that. What's the line from the Upanishads? We're dreamers who dream inside the dream, something like that.
Something
I forget.
Like that, actually, my pal Helen would know that quote.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. 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 That was also in Twin Peaks, The Return. I should know this. Yeah. 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 I think that's what it were, dreamers that live inside the dream. So I have a question. One of the kinds of dreams that you talk about in one of the chapters there are, you kind of combine two things. You combine the night terrors and multidimensionality.
Yeah.
And I've also had these night terrors, that hypnagogic experience, but I was wondering a little bit more about the multidimensionality and what you mean by that.
So the state we're talking about is colloquially called night terrors. What it is technically in terms of brain chemistry. It's called a hypnagogic or a hypnopompic hallucination. Gog would be before dreaming and pomp would be after. In other words, you can go into this state on your way into REM or on your way out. So it starts with something that the brain does to the body to protect itself so that it can light up and review the day. The neofrontal cortex is as active in REM sleep as it is during our waking life. And we are, in fact, reviewing everything we've done. And if we didn't have a paralysis that sets in, we would move about and act out our dreams. In fact, sleepwalking is a diminishment of the paralysis enough so that the dreamer gets out of bed and starts moving about the world. But that's not supposed to happen. So there's an elegant gear shift that happens where we get into REM, we are then paralyzed, the paralysis lifts, we come out of REM, and we are at the end of a cycle, we might wake up. Sometimes, and this can happen frequently in the matter of a disorder where someone has this so often they can barely function, or everyone has had it at least once. You're in bed, you're dreaming, you're paralyzed. The conscious awareness starts to wake up. You begin to come out of the dream state before the body relinquishes the paralysis. So, in that state, you are not awake, but you're not in deep sleep either. You're in between, and they call that the hypnagogic state, halfway sort of in between waking and consciousness. I have a big belief about this that is spiritual in nature because those are called night terrors because they're terrifying. In that terror, there have been mythologies created, such as succubus and succubi, these beings that sit on your chest and suck your life force out of you. And I don't believe in them. I don't believe in them. But here's what I do believe. In that state, our rational mind is present enough to know who we are and when we are. I am Michael. I am this age. I am in my bed. But we are in the universal mind enough to have the entire perception available to us that the rational mind typically eradicates. So, in that state, you might perceive a being of multidimensionality in the space that you are inhabiting because the mind is open to that perception. But you're paralyzed. You can't move. It feels like something's sitting on your chest and you can't breathe. But you're perceiving multidimensionality. Then the body and the perception bleeds and blends. I'm perceiving something multidimensional. It must be evil because I can't move and I can't breathe. Now, I don't think that that's the end of the story. I have spoken to one person in particular, and one a little bit less intensely as the young man I once met, who had so many night terrors, he decided to do an experiment. And every morning when this would happen, he would relax, he would go into breath and meditation. And he transformed a terrifying multidimensional experience into a beautiful, light, goddessy, energetic form that he could dance with in that hypnagogic state. That was the first time that I started thinking about this. Well, wait a minute. This sounds to me like a universal experience that. Now I started to add all of the people I had been either met or read about that claimed to have been abducted by aliens. They experienced that in a night terror, in the hypnagogic state. So, like, do I believe that people have been sort of taken from their beds up into the sky in a like a beam me up, Scotty? No, I don't. But I do believe that people can be in a hypnagogic state. Perceive dimensions of energy that has beings that inhabit it that we are always interacting with, even right here, right now, you and I, Nick. You're in your space, I'm in mine, and we're all in a mess and a pile and a recipe of multidimensional experiencing. But the best state to perceive that in is this in-between state, but it's terrifying.
Yeah, well, what I find terrifying about it is the paralysis. And I'll share two things. One is that what I find so unsettling is not just the paralysis, but that it feels like I'm awake and that I perceive everything as if I were awake. Yeah. And I've had a lot of UFO dreams, but one of the most terrifying ones I ever had was I lived in Pasadena for a long while, and I had this dream that I saw a light out my bedroom window. And I'm like, oh, I want to see what that is. And this is the only time this has ever happened where in this state, I actually got up out of the bed and I went to this back area. There was glass sliding doors that looked out back because I wanted to get a better view of this light. And so I move into that area. And then all of a sudden this light, it was like a tractor beam where it hit me with light. And then I started lifting up, and that's where the paralysis set in. And that's what woke me up, because that there was that fear, and it wasn't just fear of being paralyzed, but it was fear of being caught
by the tractor beam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. See, to me, this is exactly that in the dream state, because you're open to multidimensional perceptions, right, you're having this dream of a backyard and a light thing. But there's also something, for lack of a better way of saying it, Nick, there's something real happening too.
Right, right, right.
That was about a connection to a light. And I would suspect that these tales that people tell of sort of going into that state and being taken somewhere else and worked on, which I haven't had anything close to that experience, so I can't empirically, anecdotally say, oh yeah, I know that because I've had it. But I think that you're talking about your experience, to me, sounds like the overture.
Right.
Or something that might be more definitive in the light.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like the idea as well that it can, that there maybe, I don't know how you want to phrase it, but I don't want to say entities, but energies.
I like energies better than entities. Yeah, you know why? Entities allow a person who's perceiving them to give it consciousness that is human.
Right.
Human would be like, I don't like you, I'm going to grab you.
Yeah.
Humans do that.
Right.
Energies don't have free will like that. You know, a dark energy or entity, whatever you want to call it, only attaches because you're a vibrational match for it from like low and heavy emotionality and thoughts.
Right.
But I don't think they fly around going, ooh, Nick's been bad this week. I think I'll attach to him. Right.
Right. Well, I will counter that a little bit. The very first apartment I had in Los Angeles was haunted. And and there were neighbors. I was sitting outside one night and some neighbors were coming in and out, and they stopped and they started talking, and they started talking about their experiences
of the hauntedness.
Yes. It was an old hotel that had been turned into apartments. It was down by the tar pits. It was right by Wilshire and Fairfax. And one night I had the hypnagogic experience, and whatever was there, it was that classic experience of it, like sitting on my chest, but it just felt like it was this thing that was present. And what woke me up is it got really close to my face and it just screamed at me, I'm here. And that's what woke me up.
But I love that. I would say that that is about that it's perceivable.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, that entity, if what it said to you was, I'm here, then its motivation couldn't have been to oppress you. Its motivation would be to be seen and known by you.
Yeah. 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 It was a weird apartment. If I knew the ghost hunting stuff then that I know now, I would have had all my meters out and everything. But I know we're getting close to the end, but I also wanted to talk about dreams and problem solving. And you write about the language you use is petitioning your dreams.
Yeah.
I know it a little bit different in terms of dream incubation.
Yes, that's another perfect.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even know why I use petitioning or preferred. It would just be that it got handed to me as a way of describing it first, but I love the term incubation is juicy because of it implies that you're holding something really warmly and safely because it's going to birth something.
Right.
Right. So that's what we're asking our dreams to do in a petitioning experience. We're going to ask them to reveal something to us, but we got to ask, right? And
Right.
So the idea of petitioning or doing dream incubation starts with, I got a challenge, a problem, an obstacle, a decision I have to make, and I'm, you know, baffled by it. I might, you know, sit down with my dream journal before I go to bed and go, hey, dreams, or hey, higher self, send me a dream to address this, you know, challenge, problem, or conflict that I'm having. And then you just have to work with the dream that comes. So this is something you do. This is work that you do for yourself.
Yes, I do try. Yes. What I like to do, and I've had mixed results, I find that there is a precognitive element to some of my dreams, and even not just immediate. So yeah, but I do ask for an answer to questions sometimes. What I like with what you wrote, and I'm going to merge this with this idea of sleep hygiene, where you turn sleep into a ritual. And I like the idea, if you are going to petition your dreams or do a dream incubation, to do it the way that it used to be done, in a kind of
That's
ritual setting.
Right. You know, back in the First Nations era, long before we were really gathering and creating, you know, powerful civilizations because of farming, we have a lot of anthropological information about how those communities functioned just from those that were, you know, lasting into the, you know, last century. And we learned a little bit. There is a lot of sacred relationship to dreams in a lot of First Nations mythologies. And so, yeah, when we were gathering in those circles around fire, you know, fires at night, you know, we had two things to talk about: the hunt and the dream world. You know, and so the idea that before we got distracted with what we now call the modern world, we inhabited this world in a much sort of lighter way that would have allowed us to appreciate the dream world as this mystical place that was part of our, what ultimately became mythologies and turned into religions. But before we bastardized all of that, we shared dreams at the community level. We appreciated that there was things being expressed for the community through the dreams that people would be having. And, you know, yeah, there weren't, before there was the Real Housewives of the Serengeti, people were gathering and holding dreams as sacred. And I think that it's possible to do that in a modern world.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm mostly familiar with the Greek traditions of going to the temples and petitioning, you know, Asclepius for healing.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's something that I don't recall that you wrote about in the book, but I want to ask you about this. And that is about healing and dreams.
Oh, golly. Do you have experiences of either your own or anecdotally that you can sort of put on the table?
Not personally that I can think of. I know someone, Ed Tick, who I've had on the podcast, and I think he's a Jungian analyst, but he leads journeys to Greece where he takes people to these sacred sites. And he works a lot with veterans as well, who have a lot of, you know, like anxiety and PTSD and whatnot. And they go through these kind of the ancient rituals where they will spend the night in the grove or at the temple, and people will ask for a healing dream.
Healing.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so I didn't write about it because I don't have any lived experience that would have even had that show up on my outline. And in some ways it's like, ooh, I wish we had had this conversation before I wrote that outline, because what I did to write most of these chapters is, I mean, I had my own experiences and I had dreamers that I have relationships with, but I just asked people who follow me to share specific types of dreams with me, and I got them. As a quick example, there was a chapter in the original outline on astral projection. But I didn't write about that because I've never left this body. I mean, I have profound ways that I experience our multidimensional, you know, beingness, but leaving the body. In fact, my moniker, you know, in my brand is conscious embodiment. You're ambassador to conscious embodiment, because, man, I'm from here. I'm not from like some other like star system. Like, I'm from Gaia. It's like, I will show you how the body works here on Earth. And so, because I've never left my body, I didn't have a reservoir to even receive other people's stories to talk about them. Similarly, this idea of healing dreams, I didn't have the reservoir, but like, I don't care that I didn't write a chapter on astral travel.
Right.
But I would love to investigate what you're talking about a little bit more, because it stands to reason that if our beingness is bigger than the body and our mind is the perception of our beingness, but not our beingness, that we've got to get rid of that, quiet it down, and let the instrument, the whole instrument, be healed, while all of that attended energy that's around us can work on us, and we're not resisting it with our waking mind. So what a beautiful idea to explore.
Yeah. It seems consistent with the whole notion of, if there's something going on in your life that you need help with, to ask for it, you know, to say, hey, can you help me with this? Can you guide
Certainly
me?
Certainly, in the dream petitioning perspective, there might be a thing where you're like, hey, give me some information from the universal mind to help me with the obstacle I'm experiencing with my body.
Yeah.
That would be a perfect dream petition conflict to ask your unconscious to say, what do you want me to know about this physical limitation I'm having so that I might experience a healing?
Yeah. So the last question I want to ask you before we wrap up is, for anyone who says, but I don't remember my dreams.
Yeah.
There are things that we can do to help that process.
Yeah.
And so what would you say to someone who is interested in remembering their dreams, working with their dreams, but doesn't really recall them?
Let's first start and say that there's no obstacle to remembering dreams empirically in how we're structured, but that different people are wired to remember them well and others not. Like, so like automatically there's some chemistry in you that you're either someone who easily remembers or perhaps doesn't ever easily remember. And that's a thing. But I want to be really clear that there's no block to that, and everybody's relationship to dream memory can be increased. One of the reasons why we don't readily remember them, though we think we're gonna, like, we'll wake up in the middle of the night, go, I'll never forget that dream. And then, of course, it's just gone in the morning, is because the way we're perceiving the visual stimuli of the dream state is with the whole brain in tandem, lots of different parts of the brain working together, not the ocular center that perceives eye data, right? Because our eyes are closed. So it starts with intention. You got to have the intention. So it's part of sleep hygiene, creating a sacred approach to bedtime and incorporating into that a request or a prayer or a whatever, however you would language it, a declaration that you want to have dreams that you remember. You've got to have the recording device next to your bed. I think the dream journals by hand is much more powerful of an activation of the visceral unconscious than a recording device. But I'd rather have you have the digital recorder if that's, you know, if it's that or nothing.
Yeah.
But the third piece that is a little bit not an immediate like, oh, that makes sense, but the one I think that's a game changer is, you go to the dream journal in the morning, even if you haven't remembered something. Because that act of going to the journal and saying, even if what you write is, I don't really remember anything from last night's dreams, and pause a moment, see if anything comes, and then move on. That last act, I think, trains the unconscious to hold the window of memory potential open a little bit longer. And I have had the experience of telling people to do this and have them come back to me 2, 3, 4 weeks later and say, oh, it worked. So I know that it can work.
Yeah. And I've always found that even that intention of writing down your dreams, that once you take them seriously, that kind of reinforces the idea that you need to take them seriously.
Yes. And they will increase. You will remember more. And it's a relationship. You and your unconscious. I sometimes will say the unconscious and the dreams that we have is like an 8-year-old child at the pool. They're screaming, "Mom, watch!" And they jump in the pool, and mom's, you know, going, "Oh, Christ, I'm going to go back to my Cosmo," right? It's that desire to be seen and noticed that I think is inside a dream. And that when we do, when we pay attention, when we write it down, when we share it with a friend, when we maybe make a drawing of it, we are signaling our unconscious that we want to have a more dynamic, ongoing, interactive relationship with it. And I believe that this bleeds into not only more dreaming, but a better experience of understanding the impulses and guidance that your unconscious or the universal mind, however you want to language it, is giving to you during your waking life.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I know that we are pretty much out of time, unfortunately, but let me ask you two final questions. What are some of the offerings that you have for people who want to work more with their dreams?
Sure. Well, I have a dream circle that I do the third Sunday of every month, where I gather a small intimate group of people and we share dreams at the community level. I offer interpretations for each person's dream, but then also draw a kind of group interpretation. And I do that every month. It's a very intimate group, but you can certainly go to my website, michaellenox.com, and see information about that. I have a whole series of shadow work classes, which is about self-investigation and healing wounds and looking at the past through depth psychology, shadow work principles, and, you know, including a whole series where we use myths and fairy tales to contextualize such dives. And I'm also an astrologer, so I offer a lot of daily guidance on social media in the form of little videos. And I have an email subscription about the daily movement of the planets for people who are interested in astrology. I do astrology readings and I teach astrology. So there's lots of classes on that, all of which can be found at michaellenox.com.
Okay. Yeah. That was the second question, is where can people go to find you? Yeah.
So Michael, is just my name.
All right. Wonderful. Well, I will put a link for that in the show notes in the video description. And I'll also put links in for your book, Psychic Dreamer, so that people can find it very easily. So we could have much more conversation. I'm always fascinated by dreams and depth psychology, but time, I know. We are out of time. So thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciated the conversation, and I'm so happy that you were able to join me today.
No, thank you for having me. This was a pleasure.
And that's a wrap on episode 126 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends, family, coworkers, and share it on social media too, please. And subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Putting this podcast together takes quite a bit of time and effort. Right now, it is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I do now. As I always like to say, I'm here on the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness and psychedelics, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.